for a word podcast is brought to you by Naked City Brewery.
Well, hello and welcome, everyone. Welcome to the Air Raid Podcast. This is episode 208 in what is now officially considered a long and drawn-out series. I am your host, Aaron Roden, and this, of course, is the show where we drop bombs of awesome straight into your ear holes. Indeed, folks. Oh, my God. My friends, it's going to be a great, great show. You're not going to want to miss this one. Let's see. Not going to want to miss it. Director of film, Megan Griffiths, is going to be joining us here in the backyard shortly. She's got this great new movie out right now called Lucky Them, starring Thomas Hayden Church, Toni Collette. Let's see, who else? Oliver Platt. And just a little guy by the name of Johnny Depp. Yeah, that's right. That's right. I said it. Johnny Depp. I'm a little conflicted about telling you that Johnny Depp is in this movie, and we'll get into that shortly. But we had a great conversation here in the backyard. It was wonderful. The reason we met, I gotta give a shout out to my buddy John Totten of the band The Quiet Ones, and now he's in doing this thing, his solo gig called Dagger Hands, which we're gonna be featuring throughout the episode. John Totten, man. Great dude. I was emceeing his final show, The Quiet One's final show, a couple weeks ago? Was it just a week ago? Might have been. Who knows, man? Who can remember these things? Who can remember dates and times of things that happened recently? Right? But John Totten had me come and emcee The Quiet One's final show, which was awesome and amazing. Got to meet Stephen Tobolowsky, you know, at that show, and also this wonderful lady, Megan Griffiths, who is just a fantastic human being, and who agreed to come on this here podcast and sit in the backyard studio while it was literally like 110 degrees. It's so hot right now. I'm actually in my underwear, not lying. Megan Griffiths is no longer here, so that's okay. That's okay. I'm just going to sit here in a pool of my own sweat. The show is going up a little bit late. You know, it's summertime, folks. You know, don't blame me. Come on, there's things going on. Got to hang out with my childrens. Let's get right into it, shall we? Naked City Brewery and Tap House, wonderful sponsors of this here program. They are putting on, friends of ours, the Sibling Rivalry Podcast is putting on a Basically Friday listener bash this Wednesday, man. August 6th at 8 p.m. Aaron Jones is going to be playing, and a special guest. It's going to be great. Doors are at 8 p.m. Tickets at brownpapertickets.com. Just type in Basically Friday into the search bar, and you'll come right to it, man. Yeah, it's going to be great. Only $9. It's only $9 to go and see some great music and drink some specially crafted beer that Naked City is putting out for the Sibling Rivalry Podcast, which is really cool, man. Yeah, what a great place, right? They sponsor this show. They sponsor Sibling Rivalry, and it's fantastic. When are we going to get our own beer? I don't know, man. It's coming, though, right? It should be. Let's do this. Let's listen to some Dagger Hands, and then we'll be right back with this fantastic conversation with Megan Griffiths all about making movies and how she got into it and her love of the movie Step Brothers with John C. Reilly. And that other guy, right? Will Ferrell. How it came about that Johnny Depp was in this little indie flick called Lucky Them. You really should, you guys, you need to check out this movie. It's really great. I got it on iTunes. I know you can do it on any of the VOD stuff. That stands for Video On Demand. Yeah, go check it out, man. It's really, really great. Thomas Hayden Church, one of my favorite actors, man. One of my favorites. Toni Collette, the beautiful and talented Toni Collette, and some friends of mine in the movie. So, yeah, it's fun. It's fun. This is Dagger Hands. We'll be right back with more of the Air Raid Podcast for your ears. Stay with us.
Gone like vapor rising into space. Photograph of you, a mirror of a self that hasn't come to see its day. Sad and weary idle timer. And if we were face to face again, I'd say I said, hey, old timer, will it be okay? I was right. But faceless. When I'm awake, she's buried in the earth. Is she already or is she not yet? A photograph of someone that's to be. Or is she in the same place he is? The beginning, end, and middle parts of me. Hey, old timer, will it be okay? I was right behind her when she slipped away. She slipped away. She slipped away.
Second billed person in the movie.
Yeah, yeah. I know, I saw that too. I was like,
Johnny Depp last, John Totten.
Right, right. It was funny. Like every time I see a movie like of Lynn Shelton's or of yours, like I love the fact that I can go, I know that guy. I know that guy. Like several different times. You know,
I know.
Faustine was in.
There's
it,
a lot and, of nice Seattle call outs.
Yeah, totally. It's really I found it really very cute and heartwarming.
Thank you.
I liked it. Yeah. I'm congratulations.
Glad. Thank you.
Director
it.
Of Lucky Them, Megan Griffiths. I find it hard to say your last name.
You
I don't
are not
know
alone.
Why.
A lot of people
the
find
S.
it hard. It's the S.
It's the S.
The THS is hard.
Yeah, yeah. Megan Griffiths joining me in the backyard. Welcome.
Thank you.
And thank you so much for taking time out of your Saturday.
I'm happy to
be come
here.
And join me. director of Lucky Them, if I didn't say that already, and like I said, I just watched it this morning. I'm a little bit embarrassed that saying that.
Why? You watched
because
it.
I should have like watched it like 2 weeks ago.
So you could stew on it and think of lots of
exactly.
interesting rewatching
yeah.
it a couple times.
Yeah.
No, it's all right. It's fresh in your mind.
There
good.
You go, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm happy anyone watches it once.
Yeah. Now, before we talk about the movie, though, I just want to talk about you and how you got into this whole movie making business. Do you consider yourself a director or a filmmaker? What would you call yourself?
I usually say I'm a working filmmaker.
Okay.
I think that's for many years of working in other parts. Like, I also do other things, like
sure.
I write and produce and have in the past been an assistant director and editor and a cinematographer, so... Filmmaker feels like it encompasses more things.
Get a little bit closer. You can push that mic right into your face.
Get right here.
Don't worry, I clean these little these little windscreens.
Okay.
So they're clean.
They I won't. I try. I'll still try not to.
They shouldn't
touch it
smell
with my
like
lips.
Peanut butter or anything like that. So that's good. So you consider yourself more of a filmmaker, and that's like an all encompassing term, right?
Yeah.
Like producer.
And it's and yeah, everything. And it's I don't know, for some reason director I certainly wouldn't shy away from that term, but it doesn't feel like it quite represents everything that I try to do.
Sure.
So
sure.
Yeah.
Well, that's a good answer.
Yeah. Thanks.
So how did you get into this business? What prompted you to start making films?
Let's see. I went to film school in Ohio, of all places.
Is that where you're from?
Originally, it is where I'm from, but I didn't live there at the time. Mm-hmm. I was born in a very small town called Athens, Ohio, and then we moved around a lot. My dad's a university professor. I lived in Arizona and Southern California and Idaho and England for a little bit. And
whoa.
And then I was going to undergrad in Idaho, and I just kind of made this decision that I was going to apply to film schools. I was getting an undergrad degree in visual communications.
What did your dad profess?
He professed chemistry.
Really?
Yeah. So.
Wow.
Yeah, and my mom's a social worker, so I liked when it was actually film stock, it made more sense. But I used to say that filmmaking was like the exact intersection of social work and chemistry. But I now that it's all digital, the joke doesn't work as well.
Right,
but
yeah.
But yeah, so he was a chemistry professor and moved around a bit.
What the hell was that like? Was he like a strict? Because every movie that I've seen with like a professor as a father, is they're always very they're buried in books. And they're never there.
He traveled a lot for stuff, but he's, you know, he wasn't always, he's a pretty jovial British man, my dad.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Yeah.
And he's great. And you know,
he wasn't like the Indiana Jones of chemistry professors, was he?
Oh no, sadly. But, he and I did have a failed attempt at him trying to be my science tutor in high school, and
it
didn't go well. So we just had to
like
stop.
Too smart for it. Like,
yeah, it was way too dumb for the level that he was
he
at.
Knew too much.
He was just like, "How do you not get this?" And I'd be like, "I just I have an aversion to science." And so I just, I think if I hadn't had a chemistry professor for a dad, I may have actually like enjoyed science more, but I think it was my form of rebellion to do badly in science classes.
Oh, that's hilarious. I had a very similar experience to that. It's funny you said that because I had a very similar experience this morning. My 3-year-old daughter and I were walking down the street. And thunder, you heard the thunder this morning, right?
I did.
I was
out
awesome.
Walking. I was worried I was going to get drenched.
I was worried we were going to get struck by lightning or something. But we're walking around, and she's like, oh, storm, you know, storm, rumble, rumble. And she's talking about the storm, and she keeps on calling it rumble, rumble, which is super cute. But she asked me a question about wind. And so I tried to, with my educational background, being in the earth sciences, I tried to explain to her how wind is formed, and I couldn't dumb it down. I couldn't dumb it down to 3-year-old level. It just did not work. And I think I made her more confused.
And now I kind of want to know how wind works, but maybe that's a different podcast.
There's a lot of different factors, Megan.
It just blows, right? Like that's pretty much how the 3-year-old, the level I needed.
It just does. That should be my answer pretty much for anything that she asked me. Because
I said so.
So you grow up in this life where you're moving all around. Do you think a lot of your interest in film comes from your childhood?
Maybe.
Moving
it's,
all over
it's
the
hard.
Place?
I've always been a film watcher.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny. I always thought that I don't know exactly when I made this. Oh, there, I can hear myself.
There. Sorry about that.
That's
I totally
right.
forgot to turn on your headphones.
Yeah, like I would always watch movies, and I didn't remember sort of proclaiming at a young age that I wanted to work in movies or be a filmmaker. But
sure.
I recently found a diary journal that I kept at that age where I did write that. I wrote that I wanted to do that way earlier than I ever thought that I had that sort of crystallized. And
what was written? What did you write?
I don't remember exactly. It's funny. It's very, you know, it's a journal, so it's very like earnest and stuff. But it was like, I am going to be a filmmaker. Not I'm going to try to be a filmmaker. Not I might be a filmmaker. I am going to do it. And that was kind of like basically the most, I just found it when my parents moved and I was going through all my old stuff. And I was like, wow, I really didn't remember having that.
How old were you?
I was a freshman in college.
Really?
Yeah.
So this is like a rudimentary vision board is what you made.
Apparently. I don't even know what sparked it. I was just reading through. It's embarrassing to read old journal entries, by the way.
Oh, yeah. P.S. Bobby is super cute.
Yeah. I am going to be a filmmaker. And I hate my mom. No, but I never wrote that. I actually just, I decided, I saved the date of it. And I decided to consider it sort of an anniversary of sorts. And
you should frame that.
I have a necklace that I wear all the time, wearing it right now, that has this waveform on it. And somebody asked me, it was a swag from a film festival. And they were like, what do you want? The waveform. And so I used that date. And so that's what, so it's like a totem, I guess.
Yeah,
but anyway, so that's kind of where I'm going to say it all began. Although I've just been like, I remember being in high school and I used to have a lot of movie parties, and we would, one time we all rented, we were such enlightened teenagers, but we rented The Graduate. Mm-hmm. And my mind was sort of blown by it, because I never really had seen a movie where I was thinking about the filmmaking until I saw that movie, because the filmmaking is very showy in that movie. And in a good way, it totally works. The style works for the movie, but all the transitions that they do in that sort of major montage in the movie where they'll like jump out of the pool and land on the bed, you know, kind of thing. And it just was like, wow, like, you know, there's decisions that are getting made and I understand them, and somebody made that choice, and it started the wheels turning.
So you thought that would be cool to try to put something like that together.
And then it's sort of like, you know, I sort of did this. I went to college and my first major was poli sci, which only lasted a semester, and then I decided to go into visual communication, which was basically this catch-all category that had photography and history of film and video production. And there wasn't a film making track at my undergrad. So I basically just did everything possible to kind of circle it. And then at a certain point within that period, I decided to apply to graduate school for film and ended up going back to my birth town of Athens, Ohio, and going to school there.
So that was graduate school?
That was graduate school.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I got an MFA and then moved here.
Did you ever start off? Did you start off by making like weird little films with your parents, like VHS recorder or anything?
My parents
that?
Never owned a camera. I never did anything like that because we didn't have cameras when I was growing up.
Really?
I was more of a creative writer and a photographer until that point. So it kind of like, you know.
Well, it's probably a good thing they didn't, because that probably would have killed your lust for film.
Yeah, I'm like, I suck at this. I got a VHS camcorder.
Yeah.
Myself when I was in college.
Oh, there you go.
Dating myself here. And I had it for a really long time, and it was the only camera. It's still, to this day, the only video camera I've ever purchased. Now I have I have my phone to get video, and then I have a Super 16 film camera.
Do you still use it?
I used it for my first feature, and I haven't used it on anything since, but other people have used it for more recent films. My friend Amy Simetz, who's the lead in my film The Off Hours, she made a film called Sun Don't Shine, and they used my camera. And my friend Calvin Reeder, who's a former Seattleite Sundance director, used it for his film The Oregonian. So it still gets used for good art, but I haven't used it for a while. It lives at the Northwest Film Forum now.
Oh, really? So you don't even have it?
No, I don't. They house it for me, and I get to use it when I want. That's the arrangement. It's a pretty good deal.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah, yeah. So what was it like? What prompted the first film experience? Like, did you write it and produce and direct the whole thing? What was it?
The first thing I made that was a narrative was in film school. Before that, I had just done like sort of news packages and music videos and stuff for an undergrad that were awful. And then I went to film school and I made my first year. Like, I made three shorts while I was there. You had to make one per year. And my first one They're all you know, pretty cringeworthy at this point for me. But the
you
first
ever go
one
back
is
and
particularly,
watch them?
I did with recently. A couple of friends of mine and I passed through my parents' home, and they were like, "Oh, look at all these old relics of yours on the shelf. Let's look through them." And we were watching, and I was just like hiding under a blanket. It was just so hard to watch. It's hard to watch stuff that's that old, you know, that's like your formative stuff. And, you know, it all sort of led to, you know, who I am and what I do now, but it's still, it's a little,
I hate
like
seeing that stuff.
A lot of like just bad directing and bad writing in the beginning, you know, and that's kind of gotten better over years, but man, it's tough. But yeah, it was good. And I ended up, you know, in school, I made those three films, but also was in this program that encouraged, they called it, being the complete filmmaker. And so they encouraged you to do lots of different roles. And so I kind of, worked in a lot of different departments and ended up trying to sort of, get a lot of experience and establish myself as a cinematographer. So I left school with a reel. When I moved to Seattle, I had like a cinematographer's reel, and I ended up getting work for several years that was totally micro budget unpaid stuff, but I was
so like
shooting.
As a is that like camera operator?
At that level, the cinematographer, the director of photography, and the camera operator are usually the same person.
Okay.
Often the assistant camera people are all the same. It's all in one person. But it was on film.
So you get
too.
A lot of credits on that.
We usually just get the one, and the credit list is just shorter. So I was able to do all. But it was nice because it's like I could move here and get some.
Well, sure.
And it's the reason I stayed, actually, is because I was like, I was trying to find this community of filmmakers because I had this great community in school that I just really loved. And then moved out to Seattle just because I loved Seattle. Like, I would always come here from Idaho for concerts and music and vacations and stuff like that. And I just fell in love with the city. So when I graduated from film school, I just was like, I'm just going to try Seattle for a year, see if I can figure out if there's a film industry at all there. And I came here and I got a day job at a film lab. And then I would do like nights and weekends sort of film work. And at first I wasn't really finding my peeps. And I finally got my this guy, Andy McAllister. He was making this movie, Shag Carpet Sunset, and I applied for it on Craigslist or something, and we sat down, and I was like, okay, this guy can be, he's like one of my kind. And I ended up working on that film, and it's the reason I stayed in Seattle.
What year was it?
2001.
2001
mm-hmm.
is when you came.
2000 is when I came. 2001 is when I did that movie.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so I was like at the 6 month mark of being here. Like, I got here, and there was that big earthquake.
Oh, yeah, the Nisqually quake. Right?
Uh-huh.
Yeah,
it was like an 8.0 quake.
Yeah. I was actually
which was like,
college
welcome
at that point.
To Seattle.
Right, yeah.
And then I went to see Pearl Jam at the Key Arena, so it felt very Seattle. Like, everything was sort of feeling sad. Like, I listened to the radio, and everybody was still just playing grunge, and I was like, wow, this is exactly like I thought it would be. And
totally.
We shot at the Singles apartment for that movie. It was just the whole nine yards. Anyway.
So was there a big, I mean, you finally found your group of I don't know, you know, for lack of a better term, film friends.
Mm-hmm.
Was there a big like film community?
I think there was sort of a scattered community. Yeah. There was there was definitely a lot of, you know, craftsmen who knew their jobs from the sort of Northern Exposure days. And that show had been off the air at that point for, I think, only 3 or 4 years. So there was a lot of people who sort of had been making a living on that. And, you know, there was...
And they probably all worked on Twin Peaks as well.
Probably, yeah. Probably a lot of overlap there. And then also there was a short-lived show called The Fugitive that was a TV show based on the movie.
Based on the movie,
Tim Daly from Wings. I PA'd on that for a day.
Really?
Like, there's movies that would come through.
When was that? Wait a minute.
That's like 2000.
Are you serious?
Uh-huh.
That's 2000?
Yeah, maybe 2001.
When did The Fugitive movie come out?
Oh, 94 or something.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Yeah, I worked
like, they waited
store.
That long to, like, make the...
Yeah, they
the
just... They really...
Television show?
Struck while the iron was hot. But obviously the show didn't do very well either. And then like there was I was a PA on The Ring. It shot in Seattle for a couple of days.
Right.
Yeah. And I was like not feeling it with these big productions. I just really wanted to get back to this like roots.
What about the big production?
Well, I worked on this
scared you off.
I worked on this Stephen King miniseries called Rose Red.
Yeah,
and that shot that here, one. And I was a camera PA, so I was basically getting tea for the camera department, and they were all British and Australian, so they all drink tea. But I learned how to make a great cup of tea, but I also learned that. Like I was questioning, I think people were expecting me to be like, how do you load this camera? How do you do that? And I was kind of like familiar with that stuff. So I was really just going around and asking all these people, are you happy doing what you're doing? Like,
really?
And all the camera department was really interesting because it was like, you know, a camera department is like, it's the director of photography. And then below him is the camera operator and below him is the first assistant camera and the second assistant camera and the loader. And then me.
Okay.
Bottom camera PA.
Yeah.
And sometimes there's more people than that, but that's sort of the basic. And I would like talk to each of those people and they would all be like, yeah, I don't really like loading and I don't really enjoy this, but like, if I do it for several years, then I'll be,
this.
You know, 20 years from now, I'll be an operator and then I'll be happy.
Yeah.
And then everybody was like, 10 years from now, I'll be happy and I'll just do all these things until I become happy. And the only people who actually seemed to like what they were doing were the people who were sort of the top of their departments.
Sure.
And it really made an impression on me because I was just like, I don't want to wait that long. I don't want to do that. I'd rather work.
You don't
want to
be 60 years old. And finally make it to camera operator.
Yeah. And I always wanted to be in a creative, sort of a decision, to say creative decision making role.
Sure.
On every movie. Like that was just like, I didn't really have fun if I wasn't in that role. And I didn't understand why I would do it if I wasn't enjoying it. So I just was like, I'd rather be the cinematographer on a $10,000 feature than a camera PA on a $20 million feature. It's just like, I'd rather be broke and be doing something I like and feel like I'm contributing to a good movie.
So
I just kind of, changed my tactic. Like I probably could have made a living as a PA and sort of worked my way up that way, but it just wasn't for me. So I ended up switching and keeping my day job and just like kind of struggling for decade.
So you quit like halfway through the ring?
No. Ring was only here for like 2 days, so I worked
for
most of them.
Wasn't that like, I mean, every time you see a movie that's supposed to be in Seattle, it's in Vancouver
mostly.
Right.
Yeah, I mean not as much these days, but still occasionally. And
there was something going on a while back when Nichols was still mayor here, like what it was, some sort of like tax thing.
Yeah,
right?
I mean the sort of thing that has changed over the past 20 years in the film business is is tax incentives for filming, and Canada was way on top of it. They were ahead of the curve on that so far that it just drove all this production north, and I don't think it affected very many places as much as it affected Seattle, because we also happen to have a city that looks remarkably similar to us that is in Canada.
Yeah.
And so people would leave and go to Vancouver.
That's
and shoot
only
in Vancouver.
100 miles north.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And people had just like there was a huge boon in production there. It's still, they shoot, I don't know, 30, 40 productions a year there and TV shows and stuff. And so it's a good industry even now, but now we at least have competing incentive programs in most states.
Good.
There's probably 10 states that don't have an incentive of some kind. Washington has a 30% cashback incentive, which is a pretty competitive percentage. Like it's all based on what you spend in Washington, and you get 30% back of every dollar that you spend on Washington people or in industries or whatever. But we have a low cap on how much they can give back to productions.
So it's amazing for indie. So it's amazing for indie flex.
Yeah, but we're also trying to attract bigger things because they spend more money.
Yeah.
Like this year, there's a $9 million film shooting right now in Seattle. And then there's like a...
What's that?
It's called Captain Fantastic. It's shooting as we speak with Viggo Mortensen.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
He was like a scene in like Mount Vernon a little bit ago or something like that.
Sounds right. Yeah. And then there's a Spokane sci-fi series about zombies that's getting, and so both between those two productions, they're getting all of the tax incentive money, and there's no other films can take advantage of the incentive. So it's kind of a drag.
That's really dumb.
Yeah. So I agree. So they're trying to raise the cap on that so that we could actually, like, we've turned away at least, $20 million
What's
of spending.
What's the point of having a cap on something like that?
I think it's a political thing. It's a matter of like how much they say they're kind of like allowing, because it's tax based. It's like going through a tax, but it's these hospitality industries that are paying this tax and they're benefiting so much from these films coming because they're putting people up in hotels and they're eating at restaurants. And so all these people who are paying the tax, it's, they can decide whether they want to flag it for this incentive.
Yeah.
And so, and it's like, there's no problem. They never have any problem raising the amount of money that they want to give away. They could raise a lot more if they were sort of allowed to. So it's just a matter of getting the legislature to not see it as a waste of money or some sort of like earmarking of, you know, I don't know. There's definitely, there's like a lot of politics surrounding it, but it seems to me to be a no brainer. Cause like basically this year we turned away probably $20 million of Washington spend, from movies that just didn't get to shoot here.
Yeah. Well, it seems like, I mean, the just seeing movies that are based on in Seattle or something, or have something to do with Seattle, you know, whatever. That's increasing.
Yeah. It's definitely, I mean,
you see it in big productions and you see it in like, you know, stupid movies like Sharknado and things like that made for TV stuff. You know, they show little scenes of Seattle and the Space Needle and stuff, but you can tell it's all green screen.
Right.
Don't even come here.
Right.
So,
but it's better than it's definitely been the trend has been good. Like the past, you know, having been working in the industry before the incentive and then since it, you know, watching it grow, it's definitely changed, the face of the city and the industry here, and it's getting better. And now we're just kind of hitting the ceiling of the cap and now try, because like now we have all these people who want to shoot here. Cause the great thing's been all these people have come here, had a good experience and they want to come back and shoot their next movie here.
Uh-huh.
It's not just local filmmakers taking advantage of it. It's like all these other people and they like they're being turned away and that's so frustrating. And so anyway, I'm
welcome,
you know,
to Tax Talk.
Yeah, exactly. It's so exciting for everyone.
Should I leave this in or should I cut it out?
You should absolutely leave it in. You should. It's like, cause no. It's something that like everybody, if they agree that we, with
oh,
us,
sure.
that it's
yeah.
ridiculous, they yeah. should all talk to their
right.
legislators because
right.
it's all coming up for renewal next
yeah.
year.
People in Texas will not care for this section of the conversation, but that's fine.
They have
that's
their own fine. Incentive, and Texas's incentive could use a lot of work, actually. So they can
get on
talk
it,
to
Austin.
Their legislators, too.
Yeah,
because
totally.
I want to shoot a movie that's a co-production of Austin and Seattle, so that would benefit me as well.
All right. Well, hey, let's do this. Let's take our second musical break. We're featuring music by John Totten today, right?
Yes.
This is how we met.
Met at a Quiet Ones final show.
Yeah. Oh, man. I'm so sad that that band is no more.
I
love that band.
I know, but the heart of them will continue.
Oh, for sure. For sure. This is his new band, Dagger Hands, and we'll be right back with more of the Air Raid podcast for your ears with special guest this week, Megan Griffiths.
Nice.
We'll be right back. Stay with us.
Try to disappear. Though it's hard when you are here, I try to turn my back on you, cause it's what I thought you want me to do. Thank you.
Are you recording?
Oh, yeah.
Sexual. Oh, yeah.
Awkward.
Yeah. So, like I said at the beginning of the show, I watched this movie that you made that is being kind of pushed around the nation.
Lucky them.
Lucky them, mm-hmm. Yeah, this morning. And I thought it was really good. It was a fun movie. I love Thomas Hayden Church.
That guy is a one of a kind.
Man, that is so cool. Did you ever think that you would be in this position? Like when you started and were going to school and you were doing your, you know, you're working on these big productions and going, well, this is not what I want to do. When you started into the indie scene, did you realize that you would be making a movie like this?
I mean, it was always the goal to be making movies that were seen by more people,
sure,
and had actors in them that would sort of help that happen and to be able to make a living at it. So it's not like I was like, I'm definitely getting there at any point, but it was always like, that was what I was hoping for. And it was, so it was really nice to have these guys, you know, up in Seattle and making this movie, and all these actors that I've watched for 20 years and been they've been acting in movies longer than since I declared I wanted to even think about making movies.
Right.
So it's like they're just pros and they're amazing at what they do.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Made my life nice and easy.
Yeah. There was a point recently where, cause I asked this question of a lot of people in here, cause it's always very interesting to me, people in your position, people in, you know, like positions like Macklemore, Bob Saget, like there's got to be a point in which in your life where you just sit back and you go, holy shit, how did I do that? You know, like.
Well, I don't feel like I'm at that. I don't feel like I'm at that high of a vantage point yet that I'm looking back and there's this like vast valley behind me. It's like, I feel like it's been this continual uphill climb that hopefully continues to go uphill, but it's like I'm definitely not at any kind of summit that makes maybe Macklemore has a different answer to that question, but
I think you are to a different set of people. Like I think you are personally.
I think you're
at a point where you could take a step back and go, holy shit, like I accomplished a lot.
Yeah, well, don't get me wrong. I'm proud of where I'm at,
sure.
But I'm still like, you know, the prize is up there farther away.
Oh, sure. It always is, right?
Yeah. If it wasn't, why would we keep doing anything?
Exactly.
So it's good to kind of like, I remember in the early 2000s, probably 2003 or 4, watching All the Real Girls by David Gordon Green. He made a film called George Washington. It was sort of his big indie breakout at Sundance before that.
Okay.
And he's gone on to make Pineapple Express and, you know, what else? Joe is his new one. It's Nicolas Cage. It's amazing. He's kind of going back to his indie roots right now, but, he made a lot of big, he made Your Highness and, but his early stuff is this sort of like sort of Terrence Malick-esque, quiet, character study kind of filmmaking. And I loved All the Real Girls so much when I saw it. And I remember listening to the commentary and he was talking about how he had basically gotten his same crew from George Washington, which George Washington, I think, was his thesis film for film school. And he had made it with a bunch of people from his school that were friends. And it was sort of a big indie breakout. And
what was George Washington about?
It's just about these kids in the South, and I don't even think I could do it justice describing it. It's very much more about like the atmosphere of it than it is about the plot. It was made for sort of probably, I don't even know, maybe $500,000, probably less. And then All the Real Girls was like a $2.5 million movie. And I remember watching the commentary and he was talking about how he just got all the same people and he was able to pay them. And I was like, that's what I want. I want to be in that position.
Yeah.
And that's what I felt like. So that was like, at one point that was a goal and that's now where I feel like I am.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then, but now the goal is like, you know, I want to make a living at this and pay off all the debt that I accrued from 14 years of working independent film. So
let's talk about that really quick.
Okay.
Because I don't think this is something that people just don't realize, right? Is like, you see somebody's name on a marquee and you instantly feel like, oh, they've made it.
Mm-hmm.
They're good to go.
Yeah. And almost never is the case.
No,
no,
no, not even with musicians, not with actors, not with the director.
No,
not with filmmakers.
It's funny. I just was having this conversation because I don't know if you're familiar with filmmaker Joe Swanberg. He recently made Drinking Buddies and Happy Christmas, kind of his bigger movies. But he did
I've seen Drinking Buddy. I thought it was okay. I need to watch that then. I thought it was a TV show some reason.
But he was for a long time sort of heralded as this like mumblecore director. I don't know if you're familiar with that term, but it's like this very low budget thing and a sort of a specific kind of approach to filmmaking. And he did that for a long time, and now he's getting these sort of bigger actors and doing these things that are getting more exposure.
Sure.
And he just was interviewed by IndieWire, and he talked a lot about the finances of an independent film director. And it's sort of a sobering article to read for a lot of people, because I mean, for me, I was just like, oh my God. Sing it,
preach
brother.
It, brother.
Yeah, it's nice to hear somebody talking about that in a public way, because it is people just assume like once you have a movie that they can get on iTunes that you know, or watching a movie theater, like you got it made.
Yeah, you're like Scrooge McDuck just diving into a silo of gold.
Right. And you know, maybe if this is like the first thing I did before I had all that time to but like, you know, I spent a lot of years working independent film and not getting paid very much, and like having a lot of like, you know, living above my very meager means for many years. So now I'm just sort of like trying to like dig myself out of that hole.
Are you able to now? I mean, is it working?
I'm getting there.
Yeah. Okay, good. don't give me any numbers, but you got to be, you know,
the trajectory
you're working
is,
yourself out, right?
The trajectory is good, but
well,
it's
good.
Not there yet. I'm working on it.
Yeah.
Anyway, but it's boring to talk about money, but like it's interesting, I think, for people. A friend of mine was asking me about it the other day, and he was just like, man, it's depressing if you can't even make a living where you're at, you know, just think about like diving in and trying to know, spend the time paying your dues to get to even where I am.
Right. Oh my God. So how did the movie, were you approached with a script for Lucky Them?
Yeah. A friend of mine named Colin Trevorrow made a movie called Safety Not Guaranteed.
Love that movie.
Yeah. Big,
amazing.
Big,
yeah.
Successful indie breakout hit. He's making Jurassic World now.
He's making Jurassic, what?
Yeah,
really?
Total jump in budget.
Holy shit.
Like huge jump in budget. But he's going to kill it. I'm no doubt in my mind. He's really smart and funny and great person. He and I were talking when Safety Not Guaranteed was here in Seattle at
Is he a Seattle guy too?
Mm-mm.
No.
He came here to make the movie because of Mark Duplass, who is an honorary Seattleite.
Okay.
Never has lived here, but has made three or four movies here at the second movies
exactly.
here. And so I didn't work on, it was at the end of the time that I was assistant directing, which was what I did for many years before I started fully directing. And I was supposed to, that was what I was going to do. I was going to work on Safety Not Guaranteed, and I had to bow out because of Eden, my previous film.
Right.
Anyway, but we became friends anyway. Colin was a big fan of my film, The Off Hours, which was at Sundance in 2011. And he and I were hanging out with our friend Lacey Levitt, another local film person. And we were at the Mecca across from the Uptown, and we were talking during his screening. Because we'd all seen the movie, and he was telling me about this movie, Lucky Them, that he had just read, and he was helping the producer, Emily, find a director for it. And he's like, I think you'd be really good for it. And then he's like, you want to read it and see if you like it? And then if you do, I'll try to like connect you. So I read it the next day. I liked it. And I was like, yeah, I think this would be, I was really wanting to do something lighter. Eden is a dark trafficking story. And I was just like excited to do something. And I've always wanted to do something in comedy. And I just wanted to the music world aspect of it was really appealing to me. And anyway, I really was excited about it. And so Colin hooked me and Emily up. And apparently his conversation with her was like, you're going to watch her other films and think she's not right for this because they don't represent this movie. But if you talk to her, you'll see. It's like her personality fits Lucky Them like a T or to a T. And so she and I talked and we totally got along. And it was originally set in New York. And over that call, we sort of talked about shooting it in Seattle instead. And then by the end of the conversation, she was like, well, I think me and the other producers should come out to Seattle and we can meet you and see the city and see if it would work. And it ended up working.
Yeah.
So
and was $5 cover before that?
Yeah.
Your work on that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was a couple of years before. So that was helpful because I had met a lot of musicians on that.
Sure.
And
sure.
that, yeah. So I'm still friends with so many people. That was such a fun production.
It was a great, you guys did a great job too. You and
thanks, man. That was fun. Just like basically you know, shooting, she sort of created a story based on a lot of real things mm-hmm. that happened in these musicians' lives. And then every episode had a musical performance. So we shot, you know, 13 performances over the course of 25 shooting days. And then all these other sort of like narrative scenes, and got to watch all these people perform and do and try, you know, and then act, which is, was new to almost all of them. And
sure.
it was really cool. I loved working on that.
Some of them did better than others.
Yes.
I seem to remember.
Yes, some of them are pretty impressive. I thought Kevin Murphy and Jason Dodson were pretty.
They did great, man.
Naturals.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, just watching them like talk outside one of the venues. I remember one scene where they were talking outside the venue. I think Sean Nelson was.
Sean and Jason have a great scene.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah,
and it was really good. And I was like, holy shit, man! This
Sean Nelson's an actor, man.
He's a natural.
Yeah,
he's a natural.
He knows what he's doing.
Yeah, totally.
That wasn't his first time up to bat.
No, not at all. So you get the script, you really like it.
Uh-huh.
What's the process of finding actors that fill that spot? Like Colette and
Thomas Hayden Church was attached already.
He was.
Which was helpful when I was reading the script. He was attached for 6 years before I came on.
Whoa.
Yeah, this movie has a huge, long history. I'll just briefly say, try as briefly as I can. Before I came on, there was a 10-year history of the project. Emily Wachtel, who wrote it, and was a producer on it.
It had been written for that long?
Yeah, she had written it 10 years before.
Wow.
It had gone through some changes over the course of that time. But Emily is really close friends with Clea Newman, who is Paul Newman and Joanne Woodward's daughter.
Okay.
One of their daughters. And so Paul Newman had read it and had sent it to Thomas Hayden Church with a letter saying, I think you should read this. He wanted to be supportive. And so Tom came on board at that point, because of course, you know, Paul Newman asks, what else are you going to say?
Yeah.
But he remained on board for 6 more years, which is amazing. Cause I think he understood how great this role was for him. I really like read the script thinking, I can't imagine anyone else playing this. He's going to be so great. Like you can hear him saying all these, it made the script funnier just to think about him in it. So I was like, no, I don't want to touch that, casting is perfect. And then, and then we started talking about who would be Ellie, the lead character, and WME, my agent, sent a list of people that were represented by the agency that they
wanted
to write.
And what do you do? What goes on in your head when you're like going through this list? Do you just like insert, like reading like some part of the screenplay, and you insert somebody's face into that?
No, you just kind of, you think about them as like, it's like what version of the movie would it be with them?
Sure.
Because it changes the movie a little bit, each person.
Yeah,
it's like, for a long time, Marissa Tomei was attached to Lucky Them before my time on it. But that would have been a really different Lucky Them.
Yes.
We were looking through this list, and it was like Toni Collette's name just kind of like zooms out at you, because I just love her. I think she's such a brilliant actress, and she's never been bad in anything. Not to say she's never been in anything that wasn't good, but like she's always excellent, you know?
Yeah.
And I was just like, yeah, let's try Toni Collette. And, you know, we all just were like immediately on board with the Toni Collette idea.
Yeah.
She was a big favorite among all the producers. So we sent her the script, and she just, I think, was ready to do something like this too. She's very much a music fan, and her husband's a musician, and he actually is a cameo in the movie. He plays a drummer in a band that she ends up having sex with in a bathroom.
Yeah.
The dirty, dirty Comet bathroom.
I was wondering what bathroom that was, because there's a few bathrooms that look like that.
I know Seattle. A person who identified it right off the bat.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I won't call her out, but
I thought it was a chop suey.
Oh no, we didn't shoot anything at chop suey actually, but that we sort of were playing like that it was the crocodile bathroom.
Right,
so it was
right.
A little bit of a cheat.
Yeah.
But I loved the bathroom. Was just like I saw it, and I was like, oh, that's perfect.
Well,
but anyway,
the crocodile bathrooms now are way too nice.
I know. You can't do anything
You can't
there.
Do anything there.
It doesn't look like a rock club. that's her husband cameo role, just as
that's
a side
so
note.
Funny.
But he's a drummer, and she's a musician, and she loves music. And like, anyway, she just was like, I totally want to do this. It just is a total win-win.
So it was easy.
It was, when you find the person who has their own reason for doing it, it is easy. It's just finding that person. Where it's a win-win, and it's not just you being like, they would be great for my vision. You know, they have to be really into it too, or else it doesn't work.
Sure. So, and I know that, and sorry to interject here, but like,
right.
I know that
money has to come in somewhere.
Yeah,
right?
There's a chicken and the egg thing. But with this movie, Emily had raised all the money before I came on board.
Oh, great.
Which was great because I...
So you didn't have to do anything.
I was just kicking my heels up. I didn't have to do any fundraising, which is really good for the movie. Because I am not good at that. And we would have never shot the movie if it was my responsibility.
Sure.
So Emily had done all that like work and amazingly well. So we had the money. It was just a matter of finding it was really once Tony came on board, we set a start date and started pre-production.
Now, had the character, and I think you're going to know where I'm going with this, had the character of Matthew Smith been locked in yet?
He was locked.
Do we even want to say the name?
Yeah.
I read the Crosscut.
By all means.
Interview that you did. And I thought that was, I was like, that is, the writer of this article is awesome. Because really famous person.
Yes.
Plays the role of Matthew Smith.
I'm happy to,
and you don't find
spoil
out until
it too, because I feel like knowing who it is may get more people to watch it, and I want them to watch it.
Okay,
at this point, that's kind of how I feel about it.
So it's, Johnny Depp plays Matthew Smith, who is this musician who is kind of, I mean, you compare them in the movie. He's compared to Kurt Cobain, which has a, you know.
He's sort of offhandedly referenced in the same sentence, but he's supposed to be a little like we have had at so many. I've done so many Q&As for this movie over the past couple months.
I'm sure. Yeah,
and
I counted that I've done
16 Q&As in Washington State alone in the last couple of months. But we did a bunch in New York, and the big question is always like, I can see that you based Matthew Smith, this Johnny's character, on blank. And it's always a different person.
Oh, sure.
Everybody has it. They're
Lane
sure.
Lane Staley.
Yeah. I mean, it's just like all of, or we could see that, I could see you were heavily influenced by this movie. And it's like all this, like, nope. Like we talked about certain musicians that were sort of in that vein, you know, the sort of Jeff Buckley, Elliott Smith, you know, but like we never put a, like, you are this, like this guy.
Yeah. And I didn't really see that. But what I was trying to explain is like, his character is important in the Seattle scene.
Yeah, nationally.
In the past.
Yeah.
And nationally.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I guess I didn't pick that up. I thought it was more of just a Seattle
scene. No, he's
supposed
to be someone who made an impact on music.
Okay.
And then sort of disappeared off and was kind of assumed.
Takes
that
off
he had
and disappears.
Taken his own life.
A lot
which,
of people. Yeah.
That's the real spoiler, is that there's a person who plays him at all.
Right. Yeah. So, we just gave away the ending.
Yeah, that's all right. But it's still a good journey to know. I've heard a lot of people have said they're happy to watch. They've enjoyed it knowing Johnny Depp was coming. But anyway, we didn't have him until 10 days before we wrapped is when he agreed to do it.
Yeah.
So it was like he was not on board till the very last minute. Yeah, it was kind of an amazing thing that came together.
Well, it works so well because first of all, I didn't know who the actor was.
Mm-hmm.
And I may even go back and like take his name out because the movie's great. And not knowing who it is at the end makes it so much better because it's like it has this impact on the viewer. Because you're like, oh.
Yeah. The nice thing about him is that all audience members have some kind of relationship with him.
Right. Exactly.
As a performer.
Exactly.
And so it gives you that way into Ellie's experience in that moment where she's dealing with a lot of baggage that she has. You at least have an inkling of what she's going
and
through.
And that scene when she finally sees...
Matthew
is like, holy shit.
She is
so good at like the surprise and the anger and the like emotional just roller coaster that she is all of a sudden just being thrust into. I mean, it was like
her performance in that scene I've seen
it was crazy.
So many times now.
Yeah.
Hundreds of times. And every time I'll walk into the theater at the end of the movie and just watch that scene and appreciate it in a new way. It's just so layered and good. And she and the very famous actor across from her do such an amazing job. Both
I won't
them.
Take it out because I want your movie to be seen. So
I mean, it's like whatever gets that. I agree with you that it is a better
experience.
It is a slightly better experience if you don't know who it is.
Yeah.
But it is it's such a good scene. I think it stands without that. But it's also at the end of the day, it's an independent film. It doesn't have a big promotional budget. knowing that someone like Johnny Depp is in it is very helpful
yeah,
to get
yeah.
people there. So anyway, but he's also, he steps up and really is like rooted and gets the guy and he brings a lot to that scene too. They both do a lot.
Well, you guys really kept that under wraps, man, because yeah. I never heard of Johnny Depp being in town. Like, I mean, you would have had some like shit to deal with if that came out, right?
Well, we didn't even tell our crew that really? They knew we were reshooting the scene, and there were certainly rumors flying around that it was going to be him.
Yeah.
Because we had already shot the scene.
Who was the original actor?
It was a friend of mine who is an amazing actor, and I feel like maybe it does him a disservice to tell who he is. So okay. I won't call him out, but he killed it. It was an amazing performance the first time,
uh-huh.
but it's just, you know, it's hard to know. I mean, we would have recast anyone with Johnny Depp. It was just like,
well, that's what I was going to say. It's like, well, you know, Johnny Depp signs on and you're just like, oh yeah. Hey, I know we're great friends, but yeah. you got to understand.
I know. And it was still the hardest thing that I had to do on the whole production yeah. was to tell that actor that I reshot his scene because it wasn't anything to do with his
work.
Did he
understand, though?
He got it. And he made a joke when I was telling him. He was like, well, at least it wasn't Fred Willard or something. But, I mean, it still was a blow. I mean, yeah. Nobody wants to, have to do that. Anyway, so it was, but he killed it. And everybody thought we had gotten the scene beautifully.
Mm-hmm.
But then we went back out in the final week of the film and shot it again, same place.
Where was it exactly?
It was in Carnation. And we had sort of shut down a road in Carnation. It was like nobody was there anyway. It was during yeah. a work day. Our location manager, Dave Drummond, had just made sure that everybody was sort of gone that day.
Mm-hmm.
And then he came in, he flew his jet up to Boeing Field or wherever, somewhere. and then we had some vans for him and his team and drove uh-huh. him out to Carnation. And he got there and just kind of like stepped in and was amazing. And then flew away, and it was like we were like, it's like an alien sort of landed and then beamed back into the sky. We'll never see him again.
Oh my god, it's gotta be such a strange existence.
It really, but yeah, his security guard came the night before and was like,
checked everything
you
out.
Don't understand, everywhere he goes there's hundreds of people. It will right. be there will be people. And we were like, we haven't even told our crew. We don't think anyone knows he's coming. And they're like, okay, there's gonna be people. And right, then he right. got there. And there wasn't anybody. The only people there were our crew, and our crew was so well behaved and so like locked down that day. Just like yeah. we knew we had a lot to do and not much time to do it. There was rain threatening all day. You know, uh-huh. it was just like we were on it, and it was the quickest, probably one of the most efficient scenes he's ever shot in the line. Because
did you have to give him any direction?
I definitely directed him,
sure.
and he took it beautifully. And he was like, he wasn't, you know, he was a pleasure. He was yeah. such a gracious, wonderful guy.
What kind of director are you? I mean, did you have
who
to?
Who do you think you are,
yeah,
young lady?
Come on, tell me the truth. No, like what? You know, during a shoot like this, like is it all just like laughs and you're having a good time?
Well, this
or
shoot
do you
was
have
definitely.
To, do you have to like, you know?
This definitely was a production that benefited from the vibe being fun on
okay.
set, because you know you want people to be having a good time. Maybe
sure.
that day was a little more sober than most days, but like it was, you know, it we had a lot of music on set and we were dancing around and like joking, and it helped the actors be looser, and their improvisational stuff was
yeah.
better because of it, I think. So that was definitely, it changes the tone of the set, is sort of very highly dependent on what you need from your actors, because you just need to create an environment that they can perform in,
sure,
and get their best work, you know. So you want to make it very safe and sort of supportive and then conducive to whatever tone you're going for.
Yeah,
so, yeah,
great.
Yeah.
So you have to be a hard ass sometimes, right?
Yeah, although I have a great assistant director who gets to be my hard ass
for
the most part. I can be just like the good cop.
Oh my God. I was just thinking this morning, like, man, I need a fucking intern. Like, you know.
Me too.
To send the bad emails that I have to send.
Oh, that would be a lame job for
that would
someone.
Be a total, well, that's, you got to learn how to do it, right? Yeah.
You got to pay your dues, man. But yeah, I think I'm definitely my philosophy of production and directing is that I've stole
make
some
somebody else do the hard decisions.
No,
is that your philosophy?
It's not. That's not what I was gonna say. I stole this from somebody, but I love it. And it's basically you give people what they need so that you can get what you need.
Sure.
Like you just give. You know, people need information from you. They need some sort of like. They need you to be able to sort of set the parameters of their job, and the more you are able to do that, sort of politely and directly and efficiently and articulately, you know, like the better they can do what they have to go do and
I like that.
Make you look good.
Yeah. I really like that. I think that's a great philosophy too.
Yeah. I think it applies beyond the bounds of filmmaking in life.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's a great film. I think you did a fantastic job with it.
Thank you.
And I would recommend it to everybody.
Everyone watch it.
Yeah.
It is currently not available in very many theaters. A couple.
You can get it on iTunes.
You can get it on iTunes. Right. You get it on Amazon. You get it on Xbox. You get it on almost
Google.
Any VOD.
Yep.
Yeah. It's basically type it in and figure out what way you want to watch it. It's not on Netflix yet. There's going to be a DVD in a few months, but right now it's digital.
Will there be
streaming.
A blooper reel? Are you doing a gag reel?
I wanted to do that so badly, and we ran out of time. The guy who...
special edition.
One of our technicians on set cut together a sort of a smattering of Thomas Hayden Church outtakes. All him.
Yeah.
I call it the brilliant and random mind of Thomas Hayden Church. But that I sent that to our distributor to add to the DVD. I don't know for sure if they're going to use it because it's kind of a rough cut, but... that's kind of all we have ready for it.
Yeah.
I really hope so, though, because that guy is just a special, unique brain. Like, he comes up with things that no one else would ever say.
Yeah.
And it's pretty hilarious and crazy just sit there and watch what will come tumbling out of his mouth at any given moment. And there's so many good outtakes from him and the rest of the cast. But, like, I mean, it's probably... If we cut together the perfect outtakes reel for this movie, probably 50% Tom and 50% everyone else in the movie.
Right. I love him so much, man.
He is.
If you're ever hanging out with him in the future,
yes.
I feel like you and I were very close now.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh yeah.
Facebook friends.
Yep.
You've been to my house.
Right. We went to a concert together.
We were at a concert together.
The big three.
With Stephen Tobolowsky. We need to. If you're ever hanging out with Thomas Hayden Church, you just send me a really quick text, just like an asterisk.
Uh-huh.
That's all you have to send me. And
it's our code.
It's on. Where are you?
Just like
oh hey,
I'll
Megan.
Just send like a Google map and an asterisk.
There
and
you go.
Be there.
There you go.
I don't know when I'll be hanging out with him again, but he is a pleasure.
I'm just saying. Just remember,
Texas boy.
Just remember.
Yeah.
Because he just seems like a absolute mensch.
Yeah, it was really funny, actually. I'll just tell a quick story. My best friend forever from high school came to set when we were shooting at the Crocodile. We shot The Head and the Heart that day.
In
that scene.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And we were shooting a big scene with Thomas Hayden Church and the two ladies at the bar. And so we were setting up, and you know, there's a lot of downtime on any given set. And so we were setting up for various shots. And my friend Kim came in, and she's from Texas as well. And she has a military father, and so does Tom. So basically... I introduced the two of them and just gave him those two facts. She's also from Texas. Her dad was in the Army.
Yeah.
And I walked away, and an hour later, he was still talking to her. And she was like, I haven't said anything. Like, he's just barely had to respond.
Oh, that's great. That's so funny. That's so funny. I hope he wasn't just talking about himself.
No, I think I don't know. I wasn't there. I got called away to direct something.
Oh my God, that's awesome.
It was fun to be able to be like, because I knew that he doesn't need much.
Sure, yeah.
Points of comparison, and he's off and running.
He just seems like that. I mean, he plays that kind of character.
Yeah.
Like, there's a through line in the types of character he plays.
Yeah.
And that comes through. Definitely.
He's an authentically eccentric man.
Sure.
And it's good because I think people who aren't authentically eccentric, when they play eccentric, it comes off false.
Yeah.
But the nice thing about Tom is that even this character is so insane. And it could very easily venture into Quirk Fest.
And
he just is like, I think he just plays it so real that it saves it from being that. It's
sure.
like he's just, he brings that to
Yeah, he was great.
The picture.
He was wonderful.
Yeah.
I really do enjoy the movie. I'm also the type of person that really likes special features for some reason.
Me too, and they're dying, man. I am so sad.
Are they dying?
Yeah,
you think so?
Like, yeah, they're barely even putting them out on DVDs anymore. Like, they will only be on Blu-ray. And when when the hard copy formats go away, which they will soon, there's no special feature site. You know, there should, some Netflix should do it. I don't, YouTube should do it. I don't know. Some, there should be a place where you can find commentary tracks and behind the scenes.
Should, yes.
And I keep saying it,
I love that stuff.
Not personally doing anything about it, but like, I mourn the loss because I love those things. I will watch commentary tracks. If I love a movie, I will watch everything on the DVD.
Here's the thing I love most is like watching a shitty action movie and then watching the commentary and hearing like, you know, what we're going for is this existential feeling. My philosophy on movie making is like, no, it's a fucking explosion. That's all you need to say. Yeah, we wanted to make a really cool explosion. That's what makes me laugh. I love seeing that kind of stuff.
I have two commentary tracks to recommend to you.
What's that?
Okay, one is Steven Soderbergh interviewing himself on the Schizopolis commentary 20 year anniversary.
I could not make it through that movie.
I loved that movie so much when I was in film school.
Really?
That is a movie made for film school students.
Oh my God.
But anyway, he's basically talking to his young sort of artistic pretentious self from the vantage point of this like jaded Hollywood self. And it is such a funny commentary.
That's a good idea. The other one
is Step Brothers, Will Ferrell and John C. Reilly.
Oh yeah.
And Adam McKay are doing the commentary for that. And they are in a room with John Bryan, who's their composer. And it's a musical commentary.
What?
So they're singing their commentary as an improv performance. And it goes on. They'll just do all these songs. John C. Reilly is by far the best at it.
Oh, yeah.
Will Ferrell following him. And Adam McKay's not very good at it, but he's still funny. And it's still good. And then and John Bryan's improvising the music behind it.
Yeah.
And then they pause in the middle. And I should probably know who this is, but some basketball star walks into the sound booth and they just sit and talk to him about basketball for like 20 minutes and then he leaves and they do more singing. It is the weirdest and best commentary track ever.
That sounds awesome. I'm going to buy that movie now just for that.
Spike in sales for Step Brothers.
Oh my God.
Everyone should own it anyway. It's such a funny movie.
It is. That's a pretty funny one. Yeah. So what is your favorite type of movie?
Being a director and
a filmmaker, that's a good question, I think.
I am what they like to call genre agnostic, which is I'm not very driven by genre. I don't have a type of movie as much as I like. I just like things that where characters kind of grab me and they take me on interesting rides in unexpected directions and have relationships that feel like they kind of are complex and interesting. I don't know.
So what's your favorite? What's your favorite film?
I don't have a
Can you pick one?
I don't think so. I mean, I love Harold and Maude. Everybody loves Harold and Maude. Such a cop-out answer. Yeah. But, you know.
Oh, you indie princess.
Everyone loves that movie. but I also, I'm a huge fan of You Can Count on Me. Did you ever see that movie with Mark Ruffalo? It's Mark Ruffalo's big breakout film.
No, I don't think so.
Watch it. It's the greatest. He is so good in it. Laura Linney, they play brother and sister, which is totally weird because they don't look anything like they came out of the same people.
Maybe I have seen that.
It's from like 2000 or something.
Because I do remember really, really liking Mark Ruffalo when I first saw him in a movie.
It is the best role for him. I love him still, but he's never been better.
Yeah.
And that movie's great. I love Wes Anderson.
Yeah.
I'm a big fan of pretty much everything that Soderbergh does. And
Will Ferrell, apparently.
And Will Ferrell and John C. Reilly. I'm a Polanski fan.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Politically loaded as it may be.
Uh-huh. Sure.
He's a good filmmaker. There's a lot of good filmmakers out there.
There are.
Lynn Shelton. Yeah. She's pretty good.
Lynn? Yeah. We had her on the show a while back.
Did you?
Yeah. When $5 Cupboard came
out. Oh, nice.
Yeah, I've been trying ever since to get her back on.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Well, what's she doing that's so important?
Fucking sitting around, selling her house.
She just went to L.A. to shoot two TV shows back to back.
God.
She's got a busy life.
Yeah, totally. You ever think that you'll make the jump to television?
I would love to. I have been trying to do that. It's hard to break into that world. This is not at all a reflection of how talented she is, but she caught a bit of a break she was able to do Mad Men as her first show, which
is
huge.
Yeah.
And I think it was because the creator is a fan of Hump Day and like, you know,
that was a fantastic movie.
I love Hump Day. I think it's such a good film. And so, you know, kudos to him for seeing the talent. And so once you do that movie or that show, you know,
opens a lot of doors,
ticket.
Man.
Well,
heck yeah.
Yeah. And she's been working really hard in that world. And I just haven't, I have been sort of trying to break into it, but it's want you to have done some other TV. That's what's just hard.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
It's hard to get your first job at a certain parameters.
But. Well, and right now too. I mean, same for filmmakers. It's hard to get a first job right now, apparently.
Yeah. Everybody, I mean, it's like, understandably, everyone wants someone with an with very specific experience.
Exactly.
And so it's just hard to get the first step. But
yeah,
I'm working on it.
I think you're doing a great job, and you're on your way, Megan.
Oh, thanks. Phew.
Well, thank you so much for joining me. This has been a real pleasure.
Likewise.
Like I said, I love the movie. I want to actually go back and watch I think it's more of a documentary on the guy from Enumclaw.
Absolutely, watch it. Zoo.
Zoo. Yeah.
It's such a good film. I'm a co-producer on it, and it's certainly had the potential to be really salacious and terrible, but it's so artistic and beautiful. It's such a good approach to the
material. I really want to see that big story here in Washington.
Yeah.
What was that, like 7-8 years ago or something like that?
Yeah, I think that was at Sundance in 2009, I believe. Seven. It was 2007, I think.
Yeah.
It's been a while.
Guy having sex with a horse, he died.
A perforated colon.
Everybody's heard that story, I believe.
It was the most clicked on story in Seattle Times history, I heard.
Oh, I'm sure.
Yeah. And it's definitely... probably haunts Enumclaw to this day.
Yeah. My grandparents lived there. I never asked them about that, though. I should have.
I met someone from Enumclaw the other day, and I brought that up, and, you know, it's not a topic
anybody
wants to get into.
They don't
want to
talk about
it.
They don't want to talk about it. Yeah. It's like Aberdeen and Kurt Cobain. They don't want to talk about it.
Yeah,
anymore.
Over it. But, yeah, that filmmaker, Robinson DeVore, and Charles Mudetti from Stranger was the writer, and, like, such a good film.
Yeah.
Recommend.
Well, I'm gonna check that one out. Thank you once again.
Thank you.
We're gonna close out today. One more question.
Oh.
Leading back to what we talked about a little while ago. Are you happy now?
Yeah. I think so. It's like I like my life. I am aspiring for more, but I think that's a good, I'm okay with that as a balance.
That's great.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks, Megan.
Thanks.
So remember, you can find us on the web at www.air-raid.net and click on the archives page. We've got, just a ton of interviews there, 208 to be exact, with Megan Griffiths. We've got Bob Saget, Scott Aukerman, Mike Birbiglia, Surfer Blood, Death Cab for Cutie, Presidents of the United States of America, Mudhoney, Macklemore. I mean, come on, the list goes on and on, folks, on and on. So go to www.air-raid.net and check it all out there for free. For free. Okay, this is Dagger Hands. John Totten of Dagger Hands. Love that guy. This song's called 44 Women. 44 Women, and we'll be back next week with more of the Air Raid podcast for your ears. Have a good one, everybody.
My sky grows dim, thinking of the time you spend with him. I'll love you more, maybe that's the part that you abhor. What gets me through are the countless miles with you. I'm singing of 44 women that I love. I'm pining more for the women who are spoken. I love her hair and all of the silly clothes she wears. My transfer is good. I would stay here if I could. I'm singing of 44 women that I love. I am a liar, but what I'm about to say is true. My one desire is only to lie down with you. I'm living for the moments that we share. I'm thinking of 44 women that I love. My sky grows dim, thinking of a time you spend with him. I'll love you more, maybe that's the part that you abhor. What gets me through are the countless miles with you. I'm singing of 44 women that I love.